Join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network today. It's the world's largest online community of social entrepreneurs, and it's completely free. Visit guardian.co.uk/socialpodcast to register. Now, the network gives you a space to share knowledge, discuss new ideas, and promote best practice in delivering your enterprise's social mission and business objectives. Plus, you can create your free company profile to easily connect with your peers, potential customers, suppliers, and commissioners. It also can increase your website traffic. Registering is quick and easy, so sign up now at guardian.co.uk/socialpodcast.
The Guardian.
Hello and thanks for taking the time to listen. I'm Sean McGinty and I'm your host for the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast. This is podcast number 13. This month, our subject is starting up. Coming up.
If you're afraid to ask for money, it's probably a good sign that you're afraid to sell your product.
That's a good tip from Teresa Burton from crowdfunding platform BuzzBank. And for those people listening who are ready and willing to change the world with their social enterprise idea, here's a salutary message.
If you're here to create more poverty, including more poverty for yourself, that's not a good outcome.
That's Savan Mwazen from Agunte. Plus, the problems of being a public sector spin-out.
There were charities who then saw us as quite a threat. They saw that we were going to be in competition for them when it came to public sector tenders.
That's Sarah Charlotte from Realise Futures, and we'll hear more from her shortly.
The Guardian.
So people start up businesses all the time, but the motive is usually to make some money. The support systems and financing options available to a new venture, therefore, be it a stall or a cleaning business, are all focused on improving the chances of producing as much dirty lucre as possible. They measure success in purely financial terms. But the social entrepreneur is more often looking at the issue they're passionate about and how they can, well, you know, change the world. This new social mindset requires a different kind of financing and support. In this podcast, I'll be talking to people with a wealth of experience of startups with a social goal, from a crowdfunding platform to a recently spun out public sector organisation. So let's begin by bringing together three different social entrepreneurs with very different stories to tell. Andrew Cook is from Inspire to Enterprise. They offer free help and advice to the sector. Teresa Burton is from social enterprise crowdfunding platform BuzzBank. And Savan Mwazen is director of Agunte, who help women social entrepreneurs. I asked Teresa first about her startup experience.
Yeah, so in terms of sort of the, I think there's two things to look at. One is sort of the time process, and then the actual sort of funding sources that you've got and kind of sort of realistic amounts that you can raise at the beginning. I think we were very lucky on one side in that I co-founded BuzzBank together with Michael Norton, and he had 40 years of experience in the sector, so he was bringing a lot to the table. And he had a lot of networks in place, and he's sort of a serial social entrepreneur, so BuzzBank wasn't his first. And for me, I was bringing 16 years of experience of developing e-business applications and to the table, so I just sort of want to put that up in front, because I think sometimes it has a lot to do with sort of the team that's coming to the table. Have they done a startup before or not? What kind of networks and experiences are they bringing?
Did you reach out and find that experience to work with?
Well, Michael and I met at an event 4 years ago, and he pitched me the idea of BuzzBank, and I'd sort of had already been looking at the sector and saw that gap, and it was sort of just like a natural connection where and just sort of that serendipity of the two of us meeting. I think there are organizations today that are actually helping to try to create those connections. So for us, it happened sort of accidentally, but I think it's great to see some of the organizations that are trying to put founding teams together to sort of balance the skill set and,
sure,
and the capabilities.
So Savan from Agunte, why did you start your organization?
Well, the funny thing is I never thought of starting anything. I was just doing it. I was an activist and community developer and was volunteering for different organizations until someone said to me, well, you should get paid for that. Oh, that, which was a good idea at the
great
time.
Great idea, yeah.
And as I started to formalize with things, and I was living in the Netherlands back in the days, they have a quite supportive approach, or they had back in the days a quite supportive approach. So they send you people from the equivalent of HMRC to see if you got systems in place, which I hadn't. So I had to learn doing my experience. And so they nurture you. And I never really realized that I was starting up anything, and I was just doing it. And then at some point, Well, I realized that I didn't know what I needed to know. And this is where I had to get trained and learn by, you know, learn with various people. But it took time. And there are still days in our days where I said, I don't know enough. Well, the funny thing, the women thing came along the way when I realized that most of the clients and most of the network, people in the network, and people who were hanging around at networking events or at our workshops were all women. So I said, it must be something I do or that we do. And then I realized that it was time just to formalize that and to make it obvious that it was we were catering for women.
Now, Andrew Cook from Inspire to Enterprise. Inspire to Enterprise, that's not a startup, but have you had a personal startup story?
I started my own business back in March 1989. It was a recruitment business. It was not a social enterprise, it was a commercial business. And so I have been there and done it, so to speak.
So that was a few years ago. But back then, you know, what were the networks like? What was your support structure like? Were you just on your own, sort of out there trying to do it?
I was very lucky in that, rather like Teresa in a way, in a similar fashion, I'd spent 9 years working in the recruitment industry and I was a director of another company. And I didn't like the way things were going with that company, so I decided to go and do it for myself. And it really, it all stemmed from that. I was lucky in the help that I'd got because my wife is a qualified accountant, and would you believe my father was a counsellor with a small firm service at that time. So I got a lot of help.
Right. So so let's look at what Inspire to Enterprise do then. You offer a service for social entrepreneurs, and you do that for free. How do you do that?
We do it free because we're effectively sponsored by the University of Northampton. The University of Northampton wants to become the University for Social Enterprise and has just become an Ashoka Changemaker campus. Everything it does is linked with social enterprise. And they linked up with Exemplas, who are the management training arm, commercial arm of the University of Hertfordshire. And we actually provide the service, in effect. It's a business advisory and support service that is specifically for social enterprises.
So what are these pre-social enterprises struggling with? What are the issues that they're grappling with?
Usually they've got a good idea, and it's whether or not they can turn that good idea into a business. So it's a question of whether they can make money.
Sure, but that's quite a difficult thing to do, isn't it? I mean, when you're faced with a social enterprise, a pre-social enterprise, that's going, I want to change the world, I'm really excited. And how do you deliver that message?
You have to do that before people start, because otherwise there's going to be a lot of heartbreak along the road. So it's not a question of being brutal, but we say being a critical friend.
Sure, OK. Well, Savan, let's look at your experience at the very start. Making money wasn't really the issue for you, was it?
No, but I was working part-time for big, large corporations where I learned a lot, but also I learned a lot that it wasn't there was no future for me there. Money along the side, especially when you work in social enterprise, there's one thing that you have to realize. If you're here to create more poverty, including more poverty for yourself, that's not a good outcome.
Yeah.
So money inevitably doesn't have to be the first thing, but it should be something very important alongside your other social purposes.
Now, outside of money, do women face any particular challenges that you know, are because they're women?
They do have similar challenges, but they're also something that is rarely solved is somehow the gender inequality issue. So by default, we expect women to do a lot around the caring responsibilities. And I'm not saying that men do not do them, but by default, they also take these charges upon them. So there's a lot to juggle, and that ends up in burnout and somehow a little bit of emotional situations.
So what support can be given to women to sort of alleviate these expectations?
There's one thing I encourage any women, any men who come to us actually is to really build on their networks, be really looking at the networks the way they are, the way they look, and mapping them. Network is your primary port of support. You don't have to pay for that, but you have to nurture them and really be aware of what they are. And the other thing is, along the way, you've got to put some money aside to have a coach, a critical friend, someone who can play the role of a line manager when you haven't got any.
Teresa from BuzzBank. First of all, tell me what BuzzBank does.
Yeah, so BuzzBank is a crowdfunding platform for social enterprises and charities. And we're looking that lots of small contributions add up to make a big change. And we do both sort of your classic rewards-based crowdfunding, but we also do repayable finance. So we do loans, we do revenue participation sharing. We can sort of mash up repayable finance with sort of pre-sales and pre-marketing. So we actually have quite a flexible platform that the project can create sort of the exciting offer that they want to pitch to their network. But then the converse issue that we have with that is we're trying to provide a rich set of case studies to show people about how they can potentially mix it up a bit.
Do you ever get people saying to you, Teresa, kind of, it's great you're there because you can deal with all those organisations that are just never going to make any money?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I think, what I see, there's a couple different things that we're looking at here. One is we think that lending for good, so creating a more sort of active philanthropic capital for these seed stage organizations. We have such a dearth of patient, high-risk capital in this sector. It's actually, there's similar issues in the private sector as well when I talk to my colleagues. So we're looking to create, a sense of capital that's patient, that's looking to take risk, that's looking to support innovation. And we do want that the organizations who are doing a repayable finance to look to have that ambition to pay it back. But we have to respect that, a lot of startups will fail along the way. But we wanted to capture that if the organization is successful, that they share that success back. Therefore, we can make every pound go farther. So then what we really hope is that people will then go and lend it again.
One of the things that I really like about BuzzBank is the fact that it's down to the organisations themselves, isn't it, to build their networks, to use social media, and to really make this funding happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we've had a lot of misconceptions about how crowdfunding works. And, for most organisations, the way that they're going to be able to raise the funding is to get out there and actually ask for it. So, if you're afraid to ask for money, it's probably a good sign that you're afraid to sell your product to follow
yes.
on. So I think it might be a little bit, and you can tell from my accent, a bit of a North American trait, but it's really important to get out there and pitch what you're trying to do really concisely. And it's amazing the value you create through that repetitive process of trying to get out there and create those connections and create that network. And you are pre-selling. And if you can show some traction to your mission and you're able to communicate it and what you're trying to achieve, that's a really good sign for us. So we absolutely believe that those organizations who can crowdfund themselves, in other words, they can build a crowd of supporters around them, and we do say raising the crowd is as important as raising the money, that those are the ones who, in the long term, are going to have a better chance of success. They're going to be more resilient because they have multiple places to fall back on. They've got people who are offering in-kind support, or maybe even they can go back to if they have a little pinch and they need a little bit more money. We've seen that happen. We think it's a very important part of the process of giving them a bigger network around them to provide them with that support. And if you combine that with an incubator, it could be extremely powerful.
That's Teresa Burton from BuzzBank, and thank you very much to her. Also, thanks to Andrew Cook from Inspire to Enterprise and Servan Mwazan of Agunte. This is the Guardian Social Enterprise podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. Now, in my experience working with quite a few of them over the years, young people often have entrepreneurial skills. They question, they come at old problems afresh, and they think of new ways of doing things. Perfect, you might think, to set up social enterprises and give the economy a boost. Well, yes, but young people also need good quality mentors with real meaningful help and access to finance. And that's what brought me to talk to Alex Mitchell, who's founder of Young Brits, among other roles. I also wanted to speak to what I'm calling a spin-out startup, i.e. a public sector organisation that's recently become a social enterprise startup. Sarah Charlotte is that person, and Realise Futures is that spin-out startup. So, what does her newly independent company do?
Realise Futures provides the National Careers Service across the east of England, so face-to-face careers advice, provide adult and community learning for people at a distance from the labour market across Suffolk. We provide employment support for people with disabilities across Suffolk and part of Cambridgeshire. And then we run a number of social enterprises that employ quite significant numbers of people with predominantly learning disabilities, but other disabilities and disadvantages.
That's an interesting portfolio, isn't it, you've got there? Because do they all sit together?
Yes, yeah. It works really well because you start off requiring maybe a bit of careers advice to do a skills audit to see where you need to be going. Then we can underpin that or wrap around that with skills support, appropriate training, appropriate work experience, and in many cases, paid work experience or paid jobs in our enterprises. Continue to underpin that with ongoing training, ongoing careers advice, and either people move into unsupported or paid employment within our company, and we employ 330 people at the moment, or out into the wider world of employment, because we have such a broad portfolio. You know, you can do everything really from admin to flowers.
Yeah. What was the biggest challenge? And I don't mean kind of leaving behind the sort of the public sector you came from. I'm sure there were challenges for many years to get to where you are now. But what were the challenges when you sort of said, right, we want to go out on our own. We want to be a social enterprise. How are we going to be sustainable? What were the challenges at that point?
Looking to see exactly what we'd got that was sustainable. Had we got enough of a collective mass to be sustainable going forwards? I wanted to look at where our funding was coming from, making sure that we weren't dependent upon one contract. So making sure that in reality now the local authority is 14% of our overall funding. So moving away from being dependent on one source of finance, making sure we'd got the right legal structure, making sure we'd got the right business advice, because it's a very different world operating within a local authority, even if you're trading in shadow, to actually stepping out into the business world. So making sure we've got good advice, making sure we've got really good legal support to bat our case with the local authority. And we were, you know, really fortunate in that, and certainly helped with people giving us advice about good HR companies to work with, good accountants to work with, because we're quite a big team going out. You know, 300 plus of us moved out at the same time. But all of those things, whether it's, you know, small scale finance, advice on how to scale up, advice on how to capitalise assets, all of that must apply to, I guess, smaller startups as well as those of us who are stepping out from a public sector.
Yeah. Did you find that you sort of your local, obviously you'd have had local social enterprises and charities that were trading and doing things within your area. Did you find they were a bit sniffy about you?
Yeah, there was a lot of suspicion. I mean, we'd always been a bit of a leader in social enterprise. We'd put a lot of staff through social enterprise qualifications. I'd done a social enterprise master's. And so we'd been sort of trying to champion the cause of social enterprise since about 2006, 2007. So I think people got a bit bored of it after a while. You know, oh, it's Sarah, talk to her about social enterprise.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think beyond that, there were charities who then saw us as quite a threat. They saw that we were going to be in competition for them when it came to public sector tenders. There were also smaller organisations that thought we might absorb more resource by coming out of the local authority and that they would be disadvantaged as a result, when in actual fact, the reverse was true. But I think certainly the voluntary and charitable sector, certainly in Suffolk and parts of the East of England, is still kind of struggling to come to terms with certainly the spin-out sector and the emerging and expanding social enterprise sector.
Do you think you'll be able to, I mean, I guess you'll be working on those relationships because they are really important to you, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I think what we've been able to demonstrate, particularly since we've stepped out, is the opportunities to work in partnership, to put consortiums together for bids, that where we've got a stream of funding that we want to subcontract out, then our natural allies and partners are, you know, some of those voluntary sector organisations that were quite wary of us to start with. So, you know, we fund 30, 40 adult learning, small group adult learning services across Suffolk in very tiny niche communities, rural areas. And we've been able to do that because we've had much greater freedom and flexibility to work in partnership. So I think the voluntary sector has kind of started to take us seriously and started to perceive that we're not the complete threat that they thought we were.
Alex, let's talk to you. Now, bear in mind, Alex, we've only got about 20 minutes here at most. What is it you do in your life? It's a lot, isn't it?
There's quite a bit. And I suddenly sort of listening to Sarah speak, I suddenly realised how utterly underqualified I am to be talking about social enterprise. I haven't done any qualifications or anything like that. I'd sort of what you'd term nowadays is hold a bit of a portfolio career. So I'm co-founder of an organisation called Young Brits. I also work as head of influencer relations for the Institute of Directors. And I represent the UK on a number of different international bodies, such as the G20 Young Entrepreneurs Alliance and the European Confederation of Young Entrepreneurs.
What do young people have to offer the social enterprise world?
Well, I think what young people have to offer is, as you know, at the moment, we're facing an issue of youth unemployment in the UK, circa 20-21%, depending on the figures you read. And if you then look at different minority groups, that unemployment rate is even higher for younger people. There is a potential for a lost generation of young people. There's issues around skills and opportunities and things like this. But young people have a massive amount to offer. I mean, the fact that if you listen to some sort of keynote thought leaders in this field, the fact that we're now trying to train young people for jobs that don't exist yet in companies that haven't been created is a crucial area of starting. The fact that when I was in school, and it wasn't all that long ago, although it seems to be getting further and further into the dim and distant past, we weren't taught about coding or anything like this. And now I know people who run games studios and things like this that actually live, eat and breathe coding and are almost half my age and are creating wealth and jobs through that. And this is what we need for the economy. We need to create jobs. We need to create wealth. We need to create skills. And we all need to play a part in the wider society and the issues that face our community, be they at a rural, local or national level.
Are young people taken seriously when it comes to business?
I think they are more so now, you know, with some great examples recently. There is that chap who's set up that app and has just gone and sold it to Yahoo, I think, for about £30 million. Mm-hmm. There are some fantastic case studies out there. So I think now it is that young people have been taken more and more seriously with it because you're starting to see success and you're starting to have these sort of ambassadors, which are, you know, no one can doubt it. You know, someone's selling something for £30 million for a project they created when I think he was 15. I mean, that's a fantastic example.
How do you use that example and not make it into a cliche, but yet still inspire young people? How are you using that example in your daily work?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that opportunity is now, it is absolutely flat in the UK. So long as you've got access to the internet, high-speed internet access, etc., you can almost do anything you want from wherever you want. I mean, the fact that Dundee is a major games producing hub within the UK, which some people might not have thought of as being a place for it. It is the fact that, you know, within any recession and, or, you know, within any period of economic turmoil, let's say, There is a huge opportunity for disruptive industries to start to come into play. There's the fact that larger, more established businesses tend to sometimes be slower to react, and younger entrepreneurs can come into that space and shake things up a bit.
Yeah. What are the different barriers for young people in terms of creating a successful startup? Is it access to finance?
Access to finance, a very obvious one, and it is a huge barrier to entry. There are some great initiatives out there. I mean, if for a social entrepreneur, Unlimited do a great grant giving body to provide funding for young social entrepreneurs who are trying to set up in that space, to Startup Loans, which I think has just gone and lent its 3,000th loan this in the last couple of weeks. Even O2, I think, have a social enterprise funding angle to it. So there are funding initiatives out there. And then also, as we start to see a bit of a shake-up within the funding network, you know, I think it was an article that the Archbishop of Canterbury was in the Guardian day before yesterday talking about the need for more regional banks. And I think, you know, there are opportunities like that that are starting to come to the fore, and that debate is happening. And then you look at, you know, the crowdfunding models, Crowdcube, Funder and things like this. So, yeah, access to finance is an issue. I think also, to be honest, there are, speaking from a personal capacity, there are a lot of initiatives out there, and it's very difficult for young people or for anyone, young or old, to know where to go to get the right advice. You know, social media, etc., is a great way to get involved in a conversation. But I often hear about how you can set up a business with a Twitter account, 10% off at a printing firm and £10 free worth of AdWords online.
Yeah.
You know, that that is not going to, well, unless you are incredibly lucky, and I'm sure there's some case studies out there, the majority of times that is not going to create a successful, commercial, sustainable model in the medium to long term. So I think it is a case of realism associated with the journey that that person is going to be embarking on.
So thanks there to Alex Mitchell, the founder of Young Brits, among lots of other things, and to Sarah Charlotte, the driving force behind the new spin-out Realise Futures. This is the Guardian Social Enterprise podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. So let's hear about the kind of services available out there if you're ready to get your idea going. In fact, you've already heard a plug from Alex Mitchell of Young Brits about this next company. Unlimited are an organisation that support about 1,000 social entrepreneurs each year, from nascent startups with an idea and some passion to those who've had a bit of a track record and some success but want to scale up. And what's a trust engine? If it was a new way of powering a car, well, it wouldn't be in this podcast, would it? But stay with us, because it's a really good idea to get one of these babies fired up in your drive. To stress, though, a trust engine has nothing to do with transport. Dan Lena is head of ventures at Unlimited. I asked him what support they have on offer for startups.
So every award that we make is a mixture of cash, that's grant funding, and support, and they come in different sort of combinations based on different programs, and we have different strands of our work targeting different kinds of entrepreneurs, which may be their age, maybe their location, maybe the particular environment in which they find themselves. And it's also, we have strands around the different pace that they want to move at. So we've designed our award products based on the last 10 years of learning to understand what they need and when, and we've got these different stages of development that we've, as I say, we've designed based on what we generally think they need at each stage. So when they first come to us with a seed of an idea, the most likely thing they'll apply for is what we call a do-it award, which is up to £5,000 of cash to go and buy some equipment to go out and test the idea. And I guess an overriding principle within Unlimited is just to back our judgment. We trust in people, and we want to make sure that that we're giving people who've got great ideas something new, lots of ambition, and a desire to come up with a sustainable social venture. We give them a chance, and we back them where others might not.
You back them with time, and you back them with money, don't you? I mean,
So the grants we give are anything from £500 up to £100,000, and as I say, that depends on the different stage and the different sort of scope of ambition. But they also get support, and again, the intensity of that support is dependent on where they're at in their journey. At the very beginning, it's quite light touch. A lot of it is about introducing them to each other, bringing them into the Unlimited family, making them part of the family, so they feel like they're not just doing this completely by themselves, they're part of a movement. So a lot of what we do is peer-to-peer networking and workshops and so forth. We do quite a lot of online coaching as well, and we have access to a range of mentors and pro bono partners, ranging from law firms, Hogan Lovells, DLA Piper, to Ernst & Young, Actis, who are a private equity company. They can come in and provide some mentoring support.
Now, I read something very interesting that you wrote down yesterday. You know, I don't think I'm capable of quite explaining what it is, so I'm going to ask you to tell me about trust engines.
So trust engines is a piece of policy work that that specifically my team, the ventures team, are going to be focusing on this year. And it's quite a complicated one to explain, but when a social entrepreneur comes to set up their company, one of the first things they'll have to do is choose their legal structure. And this is a huge minefield and a source of ongoing debate within the sector. And we're very clear in Unlimited that you can take a variety of different legal structures to achieve your social goals. So we back social entrepreneurs who go on to establish charities. We back them to establish companies limited by guarantee, so not-for-profit companies, community interest companies, and even companies that are limited by shares that are profit distributing and privately owned. Now, in those instances, there's a lot of controversy that these are effectively private businesses, and they don't necessarily have the same regulation involved that you would in a charity or a community interest company to ensure that the social mission is front and centre. Now, in Unlimited, we do an awful lot of work to assess that social impact. When they're applying to work with us, we have to assess that what they're doing is driven entirely by the social mission, that they've set up their company to solve a social problem. The challenge we face, I suppose, is to try and ensure that that's locked in. And trust engines is the phrase that we've sort of coined, because we think there are more nuanced approaches to demonstrating your commitment to social value than your legal structure, than an asset lock and,
sure.
and a sort of commitment to reinvesting a fixed amount of profits. We are seeing increasing numbers of these companies coming to us that are limited by shares. And therefore don't have asset locks or dividend caps, but are solely focused on social value. And we help them to try and, A, demonstrate that value, so report on the outcomes that they're producing, but also find ways to reassure their wider group of stakeholders. That may be funders, that may be investors, that may be commissioners of their service, it may be the general public at large. But we understand they need to build trust if they're to trade successfully in these markets.
Tell me, how are companies limited by shares? How does that work?
Company limited by shares just means that there are private individuals who own the company, and that may be one who owns 100% of the shares, or it may be dozens of them that each take a percentage of the equity, and that means that at the point where the company is sold, they will distribute the assets evenly amongst them. It also means theoretically, when the company is profitable, that they can take those profits as a dividends and share them amongst the shareholders, which isn't something you would have in a company limited by guarantee or a charity. There's no exit, I suppose, for the shareholders, and certainly no distribution of profits outside of the organisation. It's all reinvested internally.
Sure. When you're looking at kind of what you're trying to do, which is often find money for these kind of companies, I guess the ones that that can be sold at a profit and return money to shareholders, there's the ones easier to get money for.
Well, I mean, yes and no. There's an increasingly large social investment market in the UK, fueled predominantly by the arrival of Big Society Capital, the world's first wholesale social investment bank, and most of the investees of Big Society Capital, most of the existing institutions in this space, are pretty comfortable investing in not-for-profit or community interest companies. And making returns in that sense. With the market in which we operate, we have a program called the Big Venture Challenge, which has run for the last 18 months or so. That's looking at these very, very early stage propositions that are still very high risk, still unproven models, but with large potential. And those kind of investments are much harder for institutions to make. And it's traditionally in the commercial space, it's where the angel investors come. And as you rightly say, they're prepared to take large risks, but they also, as a result of that, expect high returns.
Sure.
And so the ability to make a profit on exit is normally what drives commercial angel investors.
So are you talking, sorry to cut across you, Dan, are you sure. talking to angel investors then? Is that sort of part of what you do?
So, as Unlimited, we don't. We broker into a lot of angel networks that exist that have the regulation and the authority to sort of make representations of social ventures. On the Big Venture Challenge this year, our major partner is Clearly So, who have the UK's first social angel network. Mm. So they're going to be representing our cohort this year. But often the social entrepreneur themselves will find an angel investor through their networks, through their industry contacts, and in the local area. They will come to us and say, we've found an individual who wants to invest their money, but also often their time in our business to help it grow, and they'll take a stake in return for that.
Do you think that some of in your experience, if you have experience of this, do you think that angel investors can sort of have their head turned, as it were, away from purely profit and exit strategies, and can have their head turned towards the social impact?
Yeah, we very much hope so. That's the principle of everything that we're doing, and Clearly So are doing. We think that it's a very strong opportunity. It's a very strong sell into the sort of the high net worth community, but there aren't really that many case studies at the moment. Now, we did a total of 13 investments on the Big Venture Challenge program in the first cohort so far. 8 of those have involved angel investors, but really, the market is incredibly small. And none of those angel investors have gone on to successfully make their exits and to be able to demonstrate the social and the commercial value that they've achieved. So we need more evidence of this to attract more. But we also need to educate the angel investors on the social models, because at the moment they're not doing the same level of social due diligence, if you like, that we're seeing in the rest of the social investment market. And it's very important for us that's a front and centre for what they do, that there is that cultural fit. And that's the point about the trust engines. Again, we want to make sure that whatever trust engines the organisation have in place that helps them sell to commissioners and to customers and to other funders, let's say, that they are recognised and bought into by the investors, that the investors understand why this is so important to ensure the social mission is preserved, whilst also acknowledging that the commercial returns are there for them.
The Guardian.
Thanks very much to Dan Lena, the head of ventures at Unlimited. So here is how you get in touch with us. You can email me@seanmcginty.co.uk or my editor, David Mills. That's david.mills@guardian.co.uk. If you're on Twitter, please tweet us your thoughts to @guardiansockent, or for my personal Twitter, it's @SeanAMcginty. And please remember to share us with your friends and colleagues in the usual way. I'm Sean McGinty. Thanks for listening, and see you next time for more comment and interviews from the Guardian Social Enterprise Network. You should join it. It's free.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network today. It's the world's largest online community of social entrepreneurs, and it's completely free. Visit guardian.co.uk/social podcast to register. Now, the network gives you a space to share knowledge, discuss new ideas, and promote best practice in delivering your enterprise's social mission and business objectives. Plus, you can create your free company profile to easily connect with your peers, potential customers, suppliers, and commissioners. It also can increase your website traffic. Registering is quick and easy, so sign up now at guardian.co.uk/social podcast.